Abashed, Sansa bit her lip and huddled on in silence. The rest was rowing, rowing, rowing. The eastern sky was vague with the first hint of dawn when Sansa finally saw a ghostly shape in the darkness ahead, a trading galley, her sails furled, moving slowly on a single bank of oars. As they drew closer, she saw the ship's figurehead, a merman with a golden crown blowing on a great seashell horn. She heard a voice cry out, and the galley swung slowly about. As they came alongside, the galley dropped a rope ladder over the rail. The rower shipped the oars and helped Sansa to her feet.
Up now. Go on, girl. I got you.
Sansa thanked him for his kindness, but received no answer but a grunt. It was much easier going up the rope ladder than it had been coming down the cliff. The oarsman, Oswell, followed close behind her, while Ser Dontus remained in the boat. Two sailors were waiting by the rail to help her onto the deck. Sansa was trembling.
"She's cold," she heard someone say. He took off his cloak and put it round her shoulders. "There, is that better, my lady? Rest easy. The worst is past and done."
She knew the voice.
"But he's in the Vale," she thought.
Sir Lothar Brune stood beside him with a torch.
"Lord Pretire," Dontus called from the boat, "I must needs row back before they seek to look for me."
Batar Baelish put a hand on the rail.
"But first, you'll want your payment. 10,000 dragons, was it?"
10,000.
Dontus rubbed his mouth with the back of his hand.
"As you promised, my lord."
"Sir Lothar, the reward." Lothar Brune dipped his torch. Three men stepped to the gunwale, raised crossbows, and fired. One bolt took Dontus in the chest as he looked up, punching through the left crown on his surcoat. The others ripped into throat and belly. It happened so quickly, neither Dontus nor Sansa had time to cry out. When it was done, Lothar Brune tossed the torch down on top of the corpse. The little boat was blazing fiercely as the galley moved away.
"You killed him!"
Clutching the rail, Sansa turned away and retched. Had she escaped the Lannisters to tumble into worse?
"My lady," Littlefinger murmured, "your grief is wasted on such a man as that. He was a sot, and no man's friend."
"But he saved me."
"He sold you for a promise of 10,000 dragons. Your disappearance will make them suspect you in Joffrey's death. The gold cloaks will hunt, and the eunuch will jingle his purse. Dontus, well, you heard him. He sold you for gold, and when he'd drunk it up, he would have sold you again. A bag of dragons buys a man's silence for a while, but a well-paced quarrel buys it forever." He smiled sadly. "All he did at my behest. I dared not befriend you openly. When I heard how you saved his life at Joff's tourney, I knew he would be the perfect cat's paw."
Sansa felt sick. "He said it was my Florian.
Do you perchance recall what I said to you that day your father sat the Iron Throne?"
The moment came back to her vividly. "You told me that life was not a song, that I would learn that one day to my sorrow." She felt tears in her eyes, but whether she wept for Ser Dontus Hollard, for Joff, for Tyrion, or for herself, Sansa could not say.
"Is it all lies? Forever and ever, everyone and everything?"
"Almost everyone. Save you and I, of course." He smiled. "Come to the Guardswood tonight, if you want to go home."
"The note. It was you."
"It had to be the Guardswood. No other place in the Red Keep is safe from the eunuch's little birds, or little rats, as I call them. There are trees in the Guardswood instead of walls, sky above instead of ceiling, roots and dirt and rock in place of floor.
The rats have no place to scurry. Rats need to hide, lest men skewer them with swords. Lord Petire took her arm. Let me show you to your cabin. You have had a long and trying day, I know. You must be weary. Already the little boat was no more than the swirl of smoke and fire behind them, almost lost in the immensity of the dawn sea. There was no going back. Her only road was forward. Very weary, she admitted. As he led her below, he said, Tell me of the feast. The queen took such pains, the singers, the jugglers, the dancing bear. Did your little lord husband enjoy my jousting dwarfs? Yours? I had to send a bravos for them and hide them away in a brothel until the wedding. The expense was exceeded only by the butter. It is surprisingly difficult to hide a dwarf. And Joffrey, you can lead a king to water, but with Joff, one had to splash it about before he realized he could drink it. When I told him about my little surprise, his grace said, Why would I want some ugly dwarfs at my feast? I hate dwarfs. I had to take him by the shoulder and whisper, Not as much as your uncle will. The deck rocked beneath her feet, and Sansa felt as if the world itself had grown unsteady. They think Tyrion poisoned Joffrey. Sir Duntus said they seized him. Littlefinger smiled. Widowhood will become you, Sansa. The thought made her tummy flutter. She might never need to share a bed with Tyrion again. That was what she'd wanted, wasn't it? The cabin was low and cramped, but a feather bed had been laid upon the narrow sleeping shelf to make it more comfortable, and thick furs piled atop it. It will be snug, I know, but you shouldn't be too uncomfortable. Littlefinger pointed out a cedar chest under the porthole. You'll find fresh garb within, dresses, small clothes, warm stockings, a cloak, wool and linen only, I fear. Unworthy of a maid so beautiful, but they'll serve to keep you dry and clean until we can find you something finer. He had all this prepared for me.
My lord, I do not understand. Joffrey gave you Harrenhal, made you Lord Paramount of the Trident. Why?
Why should I wish him dead? Littlefinger shrugged. I had no motive. Besides, I am 1,000 leagues away in the Vale. Always keep your foes confused. If they are never certain who you are or what you want, they cannot know what you are like to do next. Sometimes the best way to baffle them is to make moves that have no purpose, or even seem to work against you. Remember that, Sansa, when you come to play the game.
What game?
The only game. The Game of Thrones. He brushed back a strand of her hair. You are old enough to know that your mother and I were more than friends. There was a time when Cat was all I wanted in this world. I dared to dream of the life we might make and the children she would give me. But she was a daughter of River Run and Hoster Tully. Family, duty, honour, Sansa. Family, duty, honour meant I could never have her hand. But she gave me something finer. A gift a woman can give but once. How could I turn my back upon her daughter? In a better world, you might have been mine, not Eddard Stark's. My loyal, loving daughter. Put Joffrey from your mind, sweetling. Dontus, Tyrion, all of them. They will never trouble you again. You are safe now. That is all that matters. You are safe with me and sailing home.
The Griffin Reborn. He sent the archers in first. Black Balak commanded 1,000 bows. In his youth, John Connington had shared the disdain most knights had for bowmen, but he'd grown wiser in exile. In its own way, the arrow was as deadly as the sword. So for the long voyage he had insisted that homeless Harry Strickland break Balak's command into 10 companies of 100 men and place each company upon a different ship. 6 of those ships had stayed together well enough to deliver their passengers to the shores of Cape Wrath. The other 4 were lagging, but would turn up eventually. The Volantines assured them. But Griff thought it was just as likely they were lost, or had landed elsewhere, which left the company with 600 bows. For this, 200 proved sufficient. "They will try to send out ravens," he told Black Balak. "Watch the Maester's Tower, here." He pointed to the map he had drawn in the mud of their campsite. "Bring down every bird that leaves the castle."
"This we do," replied the Summer Islander.
A third of Balak's men used crossbows, another third the double-curved horn and sinew bows of the east. Better than these were the big yew longbows borne by the archers of Westerosi blood. And best of all were the great bows of Goldenheart, treasured by Black Balak himself and his 50 Summer Islanders. Only a dragonbow bow could outrange one made of Goldenheart. Whatever bow they carried, all of Balak's men were sharp-eyed, seasoned veterans who had proved their worth in 100 battles, raids, and skirmishes. They proved it again at Griffin's Roost. The castle rose from the shores of Cape Wrath, on a lofty crag of dark red stone, surrounded on 3 sides by the surging waters of Shipbreaker Bay. Its only approach was defended by a gatehouse, behind which lay the long bare ridge the Cunningtons called the Griffin's Throat. To force the throat could be a bloody business, since the ridge exposed the attackers to the spears, stones, and arrows of defenders in the 2 round towers that flanked the castle's main gates. And once they reached those gates, the men inside could pour down boiling oil on their heads. Griff expected to lose 100 men, perhaps more. They lost 4. The woods had been allowed to encroach on the field beyond the gatehouse, so Franklin Flowers was able to use the brush for concealment and lead his men within 20 yards of the gates before emerging from the trees with the ram they'd fashioned back at camp. The crash of wood on wood brought 2 men to the battlements. Black Balak's archers took down both of them before they could rub the sleep out of their eyes. The gate turned out to be closed, but not barred. It gave way at the second blow, and Sir Franklin's men were halfway up the throat before a war horn sounded the alarum from the castle proper. The first raven took flight, as their grapnels were arcing above the curtain wall, the second a few moments later. Neither bird had flown 100 yards before an arrow took it down. A guard inside dumped down a bucket of oil on the first men to reach the gates, but as he'd had no time to heat it, the bucket caused more damage than its contents. Swords were soon ringing in 6 places along the battlements. The men of the Golden Company clambered through the merlins and raced along the wall walks, shouting, "A griffin! A griffin!" The ancient battle cry of House Cunnington, which must have left the defenders even more confused. It was over within minutes. Griff rode up the throat on a white courser beside homeless Harry Strickland. As they neared the castle, he saw a third raven flap from the Maester's Tower, only to be feathered by Black Balak himself. "No more messages," he told Sir Franklin Flowers in the yard. The next thing to come flying from the Maester's Tower was the Maester. The way his arms were flapping, he might have been mistaken for another bird. That was the end of all resistance. What guards remained had thrown down their weapons, and quick as that, Griffin's Roost was his again, and John Connington was once more a lord. Sir Franklin, he said, go through the keep and kitchens and roust out everyone you find. Melo, do the same with the maester's tower and the armory. Sir Brendel, the stables, sept and barracks. Bring them out into the yard and try not to kill anyone who does not insist on dying. We want to win the Stormlands, and we won't do that with slaughter. Be sure you look under the altar of the mother. There's a hidden stair there that leads down to a secret bolt hole, and another under the northwest tower that goes straight down to the sea. No one is to escape.
They won't, my lord,
promised Franklin Flowers. Cunnington watched them dash off, then beckoned to the half-maester. Alden, take charge of the rookery. I'll have messages to send out tonight. Let us hope they left some ravens for us. Even homeless Harry was impressed by the swiftness of their victory.
I never thought that it would be so easy, the captain general said, as they walked into the great hall to have a look at the carved and gilded griffin seat, where 50 generations of Cunningtons had sat and ruled.
It will get harder. So far, we have taken them unawares. That cannot last forever, even if Black Balak brings down every raven in the realm. Strickland studied the faded tapestries on the walls, the arched windows with their myriad diamond-shaped panes of red and white glass, the racks of spears and swords and warhammers. Let them come. This place can stand against 20 times our number, so long as we are well provisioned. And you say there is a way in and out by sea. Below, a hidden cove beneath the crag, which appears only when the tide is out. But Cunnington had no intention of letting them come. Griffin's Roost was strong but small, and so long as they sat here, they would seem small as well. But there was another castle nearby, vastly larger and impregnable.
Take that, and the realm will shake.
You must excuse me, Captain General. My lord father is buried beneath the sept, and it has been too many years since I last prayed for him.
Of course, my lord.
Yet when they parted, John Cunnington did not go to the sept. Instead, his steps led him up to the roof of the east tower, the tallest at Griffin's Roost. As he climbed, he remembered past ascents, 100 with his lord father, who liked to stand and look out over woods and crags and sea, and know that all he saw belonged to House Cunnington, and one, only one, with Rhaegar Targaryen. Prince Rhaegar was returning from Dorne, and he and his escort had lingered here a fortnight.
He was so young then, and I was younger.
Boys, the both of us. At the welcoming feast, the prince had taken up his silver-stringed harp and played for them. A song of love and doom, John Cunnington recalled, and every woman in the hall was weeping when he put down the harp. Not the men, of course, particularly not his own father, whose only love was land. Lord Armand Cunnington spent the entire evening trying to win the prince to his side in his dispute with Lord Morrigan. The door to the roof of the tower was stuck so fast that it was plain no one had opened it in years. He had to put his shoulder to it to force it open. But when John Cunnington stepped out onto the high battlements, the view was just as intoxicating as he remembered. The crag with its wind-carved rocks and jagged spires, the sea below growling and worrying at the foot of the castle like some restless beast. Endless leagues of sky and cloud, the wood with its autumnal colours.
Your father's lands are beautiful, Prince Rhaegar had said,
standing right where John was standing now. And the boy he'd been had replied,
one day they will all be mine.
As if that could impress a prince who was heir to the entire realm, from the arbour to the wall. Griffin's Roost had been his, eventually, if only for a few short years.
From here, John Connington had ruled broad lands extending many leagues to the west, north, and south, just as his father and his father's father had before him. But his father and his father's father had never lost their lands. He had. I rose too high, loved too hard, dared too much. I tried to grasp a star, overreached, and fell. After the Battle of the Bells, when Ares Targaryen had stripped him of his titles and sent him into exile in a mad fit of ingratitude and suspicion, the lands and lordship had remained within House Cunnington, passing to his cousin, Sir Ronald, the man whom John had made his castellan when he went to King's Landing to attend Prince Rhaegar. Robert Baratheon had completed the destruction of the Griffins after the war. Cousin Ronald was permitted to retain his castle and his head, but he lost his lordship, thereafter being merely the Knight of Griffin's Roost, and 9/10 of his lands were taken from him and parcelled out to neighbour lords who had supported Robert's claim. Ronald Connington had died years before. The present Knight of Griffin's Roost, his son Ronnet, was said to be off at war in the Riverlands. That was for the best. In John Connington's experience, men would fight for things they felt were theirs, even things they'd gained by theft. He did not relish the notion of celebrating his return by killing one of his own kin. Red Ronnet's sire had been quick to take advantage of his lord cousin's downfall, true, but his son had been a child at the time. John Connington did not even hate the late Sir Ronald as much as he might have. The fault was his. He had lost it all at Stony Sept in his arrogance. Robert Baratheon had been hiding somewhere in the town, wounded and alone. John Connington had known that, and he had also known that Robert's head, upon a spear, would have put an end to the rebellion, then and there. He was young and full of pride. How not? King Ares had named him Hand and given him an army, and he meant to prove himself worthy of that trust, of Rhaegar's love. He would slay the rebel lord himself and carve a place out for himself in all the histories of the Seven Kingdoms. And so he swept down on Stony Sept, closed off the town, and began a search. His knights went house to house, smashed in every door, peered into every cellar. He had even sent men crawling through the sewers. Yet somehow Robert still eluded him. The townsfolk were hiding him. They moved him from one secret bolt hole to the next, always one step ahead of the king's men. The whole town was a nest of traitors. At the end they had the usurper hidden in a brothel. What sort of king was that who would hide behind the skirts of women? Yet whilst the search dragged on, Eddard Stark and Huster Tully came down upon the town with a rebel army. Bells and battle followed, and Robert emerged from his brothel with a blade in hand and almost threw John on the steps of the old sept that gave the town its name. For years afterwards, John Connington told himself that he was not to blame, that he had done all that any man could do. His soldiers searched every hole and hovel. He offered pardons and rewards. He took hostages and hung them in crow cages and swore that they would have neither food nor drink until Robert was delivered to him. All to no avail. Tywin Lannister himself could have done no more. He had insisted one night to Blackheart during his first year of exile.
"And there is where you're wrong," Miles Toyn had replied. "Lord Tywin would not have bothered with a search. He would have burned that town and every living creature in it. Men and boys, babes at the breast, noble knights and holy septons, pigs and whores, rats and rebels. He would have burned them all. When the fires guttered out and only ash and cinders remained, he would have sent his men in to find the bones of Robert Baratheon. Later,
when Stark and Tully turned up with their host, he would have offered pardons to both of them, and they would have accepted and turned for home with their tails between their legs. He was not wrong, John Connington reflected, leaning on the battlements of his forebears. I wanted the glory of slaying Robert in single combat, and I did not want the name of butcher. So Robert escaped me and cut down Rhaegar on the trident. I failed the father, he said, but I will not fail the son. By the time Connington had made his descent, his men had gathered the castle garrison and surviving small folk together in the yard. Though Sir Ronnet was indeed off north somewhere with Jaime Lannister, Griffin's Roost was not quite bereft of griffins. Amongst the prisoners were Ronnet's younger brother, Raymond, his sister, Lynn, and his natural son, a fierce red-haired boy they called Ronald Storm. All would make for useful hostages if and when Red Ronnet should return to try and take back the castle that his father had stolen. Cunnington ordered them confined to the West Tower, on the guard. The girl began to cry at that, and the bastard boy tried to bite the spearman closest to him. "Stop it, the both of you," he snapped at them. "No harm will come to any of you, unless Red Ronnet proves an utter fool." Only a few of the captives had been in service here when John Connington had last been lord. A grizzled sergeant, blind in one eye, a couple of the washerwomen, a groom who had been a stable boy during Robert's rebellion, the cook who had grown enormously fat, the castle armourer. Griff had let his beard grow out during the voyage, for the first time in many years, and to his surprise it had come in mostly red, though here and there ash showed amidst the fire. Clad in a long red and white tunic, embroidered with the twin griffins of his house, counter-changed and combatant, he looked an older, sterner version of the young lord who had been Prince Rhaegar's friend and companion. But the men and women of Griffin's Roost still looked at him with stranger's eyes. "Some of you will know me," he told them. "The rest will learn. I am your rightful lord, returned from exile. My enemies have told you I am dead. Those tales are false, as you can see. Serve me as faithfully as you have served my cousin, and no harm need come to any of you." He brought them forward one by one, asked each man his name, then bid them kneel and swear him their allegiance. It all went swiftly. The soldiers of the garrison, only four had survived the attack, the old sergeant and three boys, laid their swords at his feet. No one balked. No one died. That night in the great hall, the victors feasted on roast meats and fresh-caught fish, washed down with rich red wines from the castle cellars. John Connington presided from the griffin seat, sharing the high table with homeless Harry Strickland, Black Balak, Franklin Flowers, and the three young griffins they had taken captive. The children were of his blood, and he felt that he should know them. But when the bastard boy announced, "My father's going to kill you," he decided that his knowledge was sufficient, ordered them back to the cells, and excused himself. Holden Halfmaester had been absent from the feast. Lord John found him in the maester's tower, bent over a pile of parchments with maps spread out all around him. "Hoping to determine where the rest of the company might be," Connington asked him. "Would that I could, my lord." 10,000 men had sailed from Volunteers, with all their weapons, horses, elephants. Not quite half that number had turned up thus far on Westeros, at or near their intended landing site, a deserted stretch of coast on the edge of the Rainwood. Lands that John Connington knew well, as they had once been his. Only a few years ago, he would never have dared attempt a landing on Cape Wrath. The Stormlords were too fiercely loyal to House Baratheon and to King Robert. But with both Robert and his brother Renly slain, everything was changed. Stannis was too harsh and cold a man to inspire much in the way of loyalty, even if he had not been half a world away, and the Stormlands had little reason to love House Lannister, and John Connington was not without his own friends here. Some of the older lords will still remember me, and their sons will have heard the stories, and every man of them will know of Rhaegar and his young son, whose head was smashed against a cold stone wall. Fortunately, his own ship had been one of the first to reach their destination. Then it had only been a matter of establishing a campsite, assembling his men as they came ashore, and moving quickly, before the local lordlings had any inkling of their peril. And there the Golden Company had proved its mettle. The chaos that would inevitably have delayed such a march, with a hastily assembled host of household knights and local levies, had been nowhere in evidence. These were the heirs of bitter steel, and discipline was mother's milk to them. "By this time on the morrow, we ought to hold three castles," he said. The force that had taken Griffin's Roost represented a quarter of their available strength. Sir Tristan Rivers had set off simultaneously for the seat of House Morrigan at Crow's Nest, and Lasswell Peak for Rainhouse, the stronghold of the Wilds, each with a force of comparable size. The rest of their men had remained in camp to guard their landing site, and Prince, under the command of the company's Volantine paymaster, Goris Edorian. Their numbers would continue to swell, one hoped. More ships were straggling in every day. "We still have too few horses." "And no elephants," the half-maester reminded him. Not one of the great cogs carrying the elephants had turned up yet. They had last seen them at Lys, before the storm that had scattered half the fleet. "Horses can be found in Westeros. Elephants do not matter." The great beasts would be useful in a pitched battle, no doubt, but it would be some time before they had the strength to face their foes in the field. "Have those parchments told you anything of use?" "Oh, much and more, my lord." Holden gave him a thin smile. "The Lannisters make enemies easily, but seem to have a harder time keeping friends. Their alliance with the Tyrells is fraying, to judge from what I read here. Queen Cersei and Queen Margaery are fighting over the little king like two bitches with a chicken bone, and both have been accused of treason and debauchery. Mace Tyrell has abandoned his siege of Storm's End to march back to King's Landing and save his daughter, leaving only a token force behind to keep Stannis' men penned up inside the castle." Connington said, "Tell me more." "In the north, the Lannisters are relying on the Boltons, and in the Riverlands upon the Freys, both houses long renowned for treachery and cruelty. Lord Stannis Baratheon remains in open rebellion, and the Ironborn of the Islands have raised up a king as well. No one ever seems to mention the Vale, which suggests to me that the Aerons have taken no part in any of this. And Dawn?" The Vale was far away. Dawn was close. "Prince Doran's younger son has been betrothed to Myrcella Baratheon, which would suggest that the Dornishmen have thrown in with House Lannister. But they have an army in the Boneway and another in the Prince's Pass, just waiting." "Waiting?" he frowned. "For what?" "Without Daenerys and her dragons, Dawn was central to their hopes." "Right, Sunspear. Dorian Martell must know that his sister's son is still alive and has come home to claim his father's throne." "As you say, my lord." The half-maester glanced at another parchment. "We could scarcely have timed our landing better. We have potential friends and allies at every hand." "But no dragons," said John Connington. "So to win these allies to our cause, we must needs have something to offer them." "Gold and land are the traditional incentives." "Would that we had either. Promises of land and promises of gold may suffice for some, but Strickland and his men will expect first claim on the choicest fields and castles, those that were taken from their forebears when they fled into exile. No. My lord does have one prize to offer, Holden Halfmeister pointed out. Prince Aegon's hand. A marriage alliance to bring some great house to our banners.
A bride for our bright prince? John Connington remembered Prince Rhaegar's wedding all too well. Ilya was never worthy of him. She was frail and sickly from the first, and childbirth only left her weaker. After the birth of Princess Rhaenys, her mother had been bedridden for half a year, and Prince Aegon's birth had almost been the death of her. She would bear no more children, the maesters told Prince Rhaegar afterward. Daenerys Targaryen may yet come home one day, Cunnington told the half-maester. Aegon must be free to marry her. My lord knows best, said Holden. In that case, we might consider offering potential friends a lesser prize. What would you suggest? You are unwed. A great lord, still virile, with no heirs except these cousins we have just now dispossessed. The scion of an ancient house with a fine stout castle and wide rich lands that will no doubt be restored and perhaps expanded by a grateful king, once we have triumphed. You have a name as a warrior, and as King Aegon's hand, you will speak with his voice and rule this realm in all but name. I would think that many an ambitious lord might be eager to wed his daughter to such a man, even perhaps the Prince of Dawn. John Connington's answer was a long, cold stare. There were times when the half-maester vexed him almost as much as that dwarf had. I think not. Death is creeping up my arm. No man must ever know, nor any wife. He got back to his feet. Prepare the letter to Prince Doran. As my lord commands. John Connington slept that night in the lord's chambers, in the bed that had once been his father's, beneath a dusty canopy of red and white velvet. He woke at dawn to the sound of falling rain and the timid knock of a serving man, anxious to learn how his new lord would break his fast. Boiled eggs, fried bread and beans, and a jug of wine. The worst wine in the cellar.
The worst, my lord.
You heard me.
When the food and wine had been brought up, he barred the door, emptied the jug into a bowl, and soaked his hand in it. Vinegar soaks and vinegar baths were the treatment Lady L'Amour had prescribed for the dwarf, when she feared he might have grayscale. But asking for a jug of vinegar each morning would give the game away. Wine would need to serve, though he saw no sense in wasting a good vintage. The nails on all four fingers were black now, though not yet on his thumb. On the middle finger, the grey had crept up past the second knuckle. I should hack them off, he thought, but how would I explain two missing fingers? He dare not let the grey scale become known. Queer as it seemed, men who would cheerfully face battle and risk death to rescue a companion would abandon that same companion in a heartbeat if he were known to have grayscale. I should have let the damned dwarf drown. Later that day, garbed and gloved once more, Connington made an inspection of the castle and sent word to homeless Harry Strickland and his captains to join him for a war council. Nine of them assembled in the solar. Connington and Strickland, Holden Halfmaester, Black Ballack, Sir Franklin Flowers, Malo Jane, Sir Brendelburn, Dick Cole, and Lyman Pease. The Halfmaester had good tidings. Words reached the camp for Mark Mandrake. The Volantines put him ashore on what turned out to be Estamont, with close to 500 men. He's taken Greenstone. Estamont was an island off Cape Wrath, never one of their objectives.
The damn Volantines are so eager to be rid of us, they are dumping us ashore on any bit of land they see, said Franklin Flowers. I'll wager you that we've got lads
scattered all over half the bloody stepstones, Sue.
With my elephants, Harry Strickland said in a mournful tone. He missed his elephants, did homeless Harry.
Mendrick had no archers with him, said Lyman Pease. Do we know if Greenstone got off any ravens before it fell?
I expect they did, said John Connington. But what messages would they have carried? At best, some garbled account of raiders from the sea?
Even before they had sailed from Volunteers, he had instructed his captains to show no banners during these first attacks. Not Prince Aegon's three-headed dragon, nor his own griffins, nor the skulls and golden battle standards of the company. Let the Lannisters suspect Stannis Baratheon, pirates from the Stepstones, outlaws out of the woods, or whoever else they care to blame. If the reports that reached King's Landing were confused and contradictory, so much the better. The slower the Iron Throne was to react, the longer they would have to gather their strength and bring allies to the cause. There should be ships on Estamont. It is an island. Holden, send words to Mandrake to leave a garrison behind and bring the rest of his men over to Cape Wrath, along with any noble captives.
As you command, my lord. House Estamont has blood ties to both kings, as it happens. Good hostages.
Good ransoms, said homeless Harry, happily.
It is time we sent for Prince Aegon as well, Lord John announced. He will be safer here behind the walls of Griffin's Roost than back at camp.
I'll send a rider, said Franklin Flowers. But the lad won't much like the idea of staying safe, I'll tell you that. He wants to be in the thick of things.
So did we all, at his age, Lord John thought, remembering.
Has the time come to raise his banner? Asked Pease.
Not yet. Let King's Landing think this is no more than an exile lord coming home with some hired swords to reclaim his birthright. An old familiar story, that. I will even write King Tommen, stating as much and asking for a pardon and the restoration of my lands and titles. That will give them something to chew over for a while. And whilst they dither, we will send out word secretly to likely friends in the Stormlands and the Reach and Dawn. That was the crucial step. Lesser lords might join their cause for fear of harm or hope of gain. But only the Prince of Dawn had the power to defy House Lannister and its allies.
Above all else, we must have Dorin Martell.
Small chance of that, said Strickland. The Dornish man is scared of his own shadow. Not what you call daring.
No more than you. Prince Dorin is a cautious man, that's true. He will never join us unless he is convinced that we will win. So to persuade him, we must show our strength. If Peak and Rivers are successful, we will control the better part of Cape Wrath, argued Strickland.
Four castles in as many days, that's a splendid start. But we are still only at half strength. We need to wait for the rest of my men. We are missing horses as well, and the elephants. Wait, I say. Gather our power. Win some small lords to our cause. Let Lysanomar dispatch his spies to learn what we can learn of our foes.
Cunnington gave the plump Captain General a cool look. This man is no Blackheart, no Bitter Steel, no Malis. He would wait until all seven hells were frozen, if he could, rather than risk another bout of blisters. We did not cross half the world to wait. Our best chance is to strike hard and fast before King's Landing knows who we are. I mean to take Storm's End, a nigh impregnable stronghold, and Stannis Baratheon's last foothold in the south. Once taken, it will give us a secure fastness to which we may retreat at need, and winning it will prove our strength.
The captains of the Golden Company exchanged glances.
If Storm's End is still held by men loyal to Stannis, we will be taking it from him, not the Lannisters, objected Brendelburn. Why not make common cause with him against the Lannisters? Stannis is Robert's brother, of that same ilk that brought down House Targaryen, John Connington reminded him. Moreover, he is 1,000 leagues away, with whatever meagre strength he still commands. The whole realm lies between us. It would take 30 years just to reach him, and he has little and less to offer us. If Storm's End is so impregnable, how do you mean to take it? Asked Melo. By guile. Homeless Harry Strickland disagreed. We should wait. We shall, John Connington stood. 10 days, no longer. It will take that long to prepare. On the morning of the 11th day, we ride for Storm's End. The prince arrived to join them 4 days later, riding at the head of a column of 100 horse, with 3 elephants lumbering in his rear. Lady L'Amour was with him, garbed once more in the white robes of a scepter. Before them went Sir Raleigh Dockfield, a snow-white cloak streaming from his shoulders. A solid man, and true, Cunnington thought as he watched Dock dismount, but not worthy of the King's Guard. He had tried his best to dissuade the prince from giving Dockfield that cloak, pointing out that the honour might best be held in reserve for warriors of greater renown whose fealty would add lustre to their cause, and the younger sons of great lords whose support they would need in the coming struggle. But the boy would not be moved.
"Duck will die for me if need be," he had said, "and that's all I require in my King's Guard. The Kingslayer was a warrior of great renown, and the son of a great lord as well."
At least I convinced him to leave the other 6 slots open, else Duck might have 6 ducklings trailing after him, each more blindingly adequate than the last. "Escort his grace to my solar," he commanded, "at once." Prince Aegon Targaryen was not near as biddable as the boy young Griff had been, however. The better part of an hour had passed before he finally turned up in the solar, with Duck at his side.
"Lord Connington," he said, "I like your castle."
"Your father's lands are beautiful," he said. His silvery hair was blowing in the wind and his eyes were a deep purple, darker than this boy's.
"As do I, Your Grace. Please be seated. Sir Raleigh, we'll have no further need of you for now."
"No, I want Doc to stay," the prince said. "We've been talking with Strickland and Flowers. They told us about this attack on Storm's End that you're planning."
John Connington did not let his fury show. "And did Homeless Harry try to persuade you to delay it?"
"He did, actually," the prince said. "But I won't. Harry's an old maid, isn't he?" "You have the right of it, my lord. I want the attack to go ahead. With one change, I mean to lead it."
Tyrion. The slot in his helm limited Tyrion's vision to what was before him, but when he turned his head, he saw 3 galleys beached on the tawny grounds, and a 4th, larger than the others, standing well out into the river, firing barrels of burning pitch from a catapult.
"Wedge!"
Tyrion commanded, as his men streamed out of the sally port. They formed up in spearhead, with him at the point. Sir Mandon Moore took the place to his right, flame shimmering against the white enamel of his armour, his dead eyes shining passionlessly through his helm. He rode a coal-black horse, barded all in white, with a pure white shield of the King's Guard strapped to his arm. On the left, Tyrion was surprised to see Podrick Payne, a sword in his hand. "You're too young," he said at once. "Go back."
"But I'm your squire, my lord."
Tyrion could spare no time for argument.
"With me, then. Stay close."
He kicked his horse into motion. They rode knee to knee
following the line of the looming walls. Joffrey's standard streamed crimson and gold from Sir Mandan's staff, stag and lion dancing hoof to paw. They went from a walk to a trot, wheeling wide around the base of the tower. Arrows darted from the city walls, while stones spun and tumbled overhead, crashing down blindly onto earth and water, steel and flesh. Ahead loomed the King's Gate, and a surging mob of soldiers wrestling with a huge ram, a shaft of black oak with an iron head. Archers off the ships surrounded them, loosing their shafts at whatever defenders showed themselves on the gatehouse walls.
"Lances!" Tyrion commanded.
He sped to a canter. The ground was sodden and slippery, equal parts of mud and blood. His stallion stumbled over a corpse, his hooves sliding and churning the earth, and for an instant Tyrion feared his charge would end with him tumbling from the saddle before he could even reach the foe, but somehow he and his horse both managed to keep their balance. Beneath the gate, men were turning, hurriedly trying to brace for the shock. Tyrion lifted his axe and shouted, "King's Landing!" Other voices took up the cry, and now the arrowhead flew, a long scream of steel and silk, pounding hooves and sharp blades kissed by fire. Sir Mandan dropped the point of his lance at the last possible instant and drove Joffrey's banner through the chest of a man in a studded jerkin, lifting him full off his feet before the shaft snapped. Ahead of Tyrion was a knight whose surcoat showed a fox peering through a ring of flowers. "Florent," was his first thought, but "helmless" ran a close second. He smashed the man in the face with all the weight of axe and arm and charging horse, taking off half his head. The shock of impact numbed his shoulder. "Shago would laugh at me," he thought, riding on. A spear thudded against his shield. Pod galloped beside him, slashing down at every foe they passed. Dimly he heard cheers from the men on the walls. The battering ram crashed down into the mud, forgotten in an instant, as its handlers fled or turned to fight. Tyrion rode down an archer, opened a spearman from shoulder to armpit, glanced a blow off a swordfish-crested helm. At the ram, his big red reared, but the black stallion leapt the obstacle smoothly, and Sir Mandan flashed past him, death in snow-white silk. His sword sheared off limbs, cracked heads, broke shields asunder, though few enough of the enemy had made it across the river with shields intact. Tyrion urged his mount over the ram. Their foes were fleeing. He moved his head right to left and back again, but saw no sign of Podrick Payne. An arrow clattered against his cheek, missing his eye slit by an inch. His jolt of fear almost unhorsed him. "If I'm to sit here like a stump, I had as well paint a target on my breastplate." He spurred his horse back into motion, trotting over and around a scatter of corpses. Downriver, the black water was jammed with the hulks of burning galleys. Patches of wildfire still floated atop the water, sending fiery green plumes swirling 20 feet into the air. They had dispersed the men on the battering ram, but he could see fighting all along the riverfront. Sir Balin Swan's men, most like, or Lancel's, trying to throw the enemy back into the water as they swarmed ashore off the burning ships. "We'll ride for the Mud Gate," he commanded. Sir Mandan shouted, "The Mud Gate!" And they were off again. "King's Landing!" his men cried raggedly, and "Half man! Half man!" He wondered who had taught them that. Through the steel and padding of his helm, he heard anguished screams, the hungry crackle of flame, the shuddering of war horns, and the brazen blast of trumpets. Fire was everywhere. Gods be good, no wonder the hound was frightened. It's the flames he fears. A splintering crash rang across the black water as a stone the size of a horse landed square amidships on one of the galleys. Ours or theirs? Through the roiling smoke, he could not tell. His wedge was gone. Every man was his own battle now. "I should have turned back," he thought, riding on. The axe was heavy in his fist. A handful still followed him, the rest dead or fled. He had to wrestle his stallion to keep his head to the east. The big destrier liked fire no more than Sandor Clegane had, but the horse was easier to cow. Men were crawling from the river, men burned and bleeding, coughing up water, staggering, most dying. He led his troop among them, delivering quicker, cleaner deaths to those strong enough to stand. The war shrank to the size of his eye slit. Knights twice his size fled from him, or stood and died. They seemed little things and fearful. "Lannister!" he shouted, slaying. His arm was red to the elbow, glistening in the light off the river. When his horse reared again, he shook his axe at the stars and heard them call out, "Half man! Half man!" Tyrion felt drunk. The battle fever. He had never thought to experience it himself, though Jaime had told him of it often enough. How time seemed to blur and slow and even stop, how the past and the future vanished until there was nothing but the instant, how fear fled and thought fled, and even your body. "You don't feel your wounds then, or the ache in your back from the weight of the armor, or the sweat running down into your eyes? You stop feeling, you stop thinking, you stop being you. There is only the fight, the foe, this man, and then the next, and the next, and the next. And you know that they are afraid and tired. But you're not, you're alive, and death is all around you, but their swords move so slowly you can dance through them laughing. Battle fever. I am half a man, and drunk with slaughter. Let them kill me if they can." They tried. Another spearman ran at him. Tyrion lopped off the head of his spear, then his hand, then his arm, trotting around him in a circle. An archer, bowless, thrust at him with an arrow, holding it as if it were a knife. The destrier kicked at the man's thigh to send him sprawling, and Tyrion barked laughter. He rode past a banner planted in the mud, one of Stannis's fiery hearts, and chopped the staff in two with a swing of his axe. A knight rose up from nowhere to hack at his shield with a two-handed greatsword, again and again, until someone thrust a dagger under his arm. One of Tyrion's men, perhaps, he never saw. "I yield, sir," a different knight called out farther down the river. "Yield, sir knight, I yield to you, my pledge, here, here." The man lay in a puddle of black water, offering up a lobstered gauntlet in token of submission. Tyrion had to lean down to take it from him. As he did, a pot of wildfire burst overhead, spraying green flame. In the sudden stab of light, he saw that the puddle was not black, but red. The gauntlet still had the knight's hand in it. He flung it back. "Yield!" the man sobbed, hopelessly, helplessly. Tyrion reeled away. A man-at-arms grabbed the bridle of his horse and thrust at Tyrion's face with a dagger. He knocked the blade aside and buried the axe in the nape of the man's neck. As he was wresting it free, a blaze of white appeared at the edge of his vision. Tyrion turned, thinking to find Sir Mandon Moore beside him again, but this was a different white knight. Sir Balon Swan wore the same armor, but his horse trappings bore the battling black-and-white swans of his house. "He's more a spotted knight than a white one," Tyrion thought inanely. Every bit of Sir Balon was splattered with gore and smudged by smoke. He raised his mace to point downriver. Bits of brain and bone clung to its head. "My lord, look!" Tyrion swung his horse about to peer down the Blackwater. The current still flowed black and strong beneath, but the surface was a roil of blood and flame. The sky was red and orange and garish green. "What?" he said. Then he saw. Steel-clad men-at-arms were clambering off a broken galley that had smashed into a pier. "So many? Where are they coming from?" Squinting into the smoke and glare, Tyrion followed them back into the river. 20 galleys were jammed together out there, maybe more. It was hard to count. Their oars were crossed, their hulls locked together with grappling lines. They were impaled on each other's rams, tangled in webs of fallen rigging. One great hulk floated hull up between two smaller ships. Wrecks, but packed so closely that it was possible